Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
Welcome to today's episode of Growth Marketing Today. I have somebody special for all of you right now. I have Kieran Flanagan. He's the VP of Growth at HubSpot. Now, yeah, you heard that right. VP of Growth at HubSpot. Now, he has a proven track record of helping SaaS business from startups to enterprise-level companies to grow the traffic, users, and revenue. I'm excited about this because he's calling in from all the way from Ireland, Dublin. We had a chat for quite a long time. That's why I had to actually split up this episode into two. So this is the first part out of two, where in this episode, you actually learn how Kieran manages a global growth team that spans across multiple time zones. HubSpot is not a small company. You'll also learn tactics that they use at HubSpot to activate free users into paid users and how they have incremental and disruptive growth experiments at HubSpot in 2018. Now, if you want tweetable quotes from this episode and a high-level outline, you can just go to growthmarketing.today/021. This is episode 21. So that's growthmarketing.today/021. Hey, I don't want to hold you back anymore from my chat. Here is Kieran. Hey, everyone. I have here Kieran all the way from Dublin to talk a little bit about HubSpot. He's the VP of Growth at HubSpot. Hey, Kieran, how are you doing?
Hey, Ramley. Doing good.
Hey, before we start talking about growth and other things that you're doing at HubSpot, can you tell me a little bit about your career journey so far?
Yeah, for sure. So I come from an actual computer science background. So I got an honors degree in computer science. I went into software development. I was average, very average at software development, and realized throughout my career as a software developer that I struggled to put in the hours I'd want to put into my career. As in, outside of development, I just wasn't extremely passionate about reading books on. At the time, I was actually developing in Python, Perl, Unix, like not these kind of sexy languages that we have today. So I went back and started again. So I started actually in a graduate role as an SEO, which was interesting because restarting again actually gave me a lot of freedom because I had a lot more knowledge about where I wanted to end up. And that was the good thing about starting a career again. And so I ended up running a search team. In my spare time, I was building affiliate sites and kind of doing anything I could to kind of fast track my career. So basically, how could I acquire knowledge quite quickly? And so in that time, what actually happens if you're an SEO and you're good at it and you want to fast track your career, you end up dabbling in the dark arts. So I built myself a link network using drop domains. And
nice.
For 6 months, thought I was God because I could rank anything and was buying up a lot of websites and building a lot of websites and investing a lot of money and making some back. And then woke up one Saturday morning, I still remember it, came in with my coffee, ready to do another hard day's work on a Saturday. And none of my sites were in Google anymore. And Google had rightfully so DNS'd all my sites. And then thought, wow, I should actually go learn to do real marketing. Took a job with Salesforce, ran some of their inbound marketing in Europe. And when I was there, was the real first person to launch content for Salesforce. We weren't really even doing a blog when I was there. So launched a bunch of different blogs across different regions and hit my organic traffic goal within 6 weeks. Actually, I remember hitting it in February because we had never done this kind of informational inbound marketing play before in Salesforce. And I was like, oh, this is pretty powerful. Wanted to go work at a startup or a smaller company. So went to work for Marketo when they opened their office in Dublin and then stayed there for a little bit. And then did the same with HubSpot when they opened up here. And then HubSpot, I built out the international marketing team and then built out the freemium marketing team. So I've kind of had two missions in HubSpot to date. That's kind of the summary of how I ended up where I am today.
Well, nice, man. That's pretty cool. I guess you're starting to talk a little bit about that, your international team. What does your growth team look like right now? Like, how international is it?
Yeah, so like my two missions, my two missions at HubSpot are actually different from each other. So for the first 2 years, I built out our international marketing team. So when I joined in Dublin, we had opened our European headquarters here, and we were a team of 12 people. And internationally now, like our international whole company was 12 people. And I think today we're probably 400, 500, 600. And I built out the international marketing team. So basically, how do we build the HubSpot international business outside of NorthAm? I did that for like just over 2 years. And then I HubSpot really pushed into freemium, and that's a big part of a go-to-market, and I built out that team. So the teams I have currently actually acquire all of our free users and then work with product and engineers to activate those users and monetize those users into revenue via either connecting with a human or going through a touchless flow. And then as part of that, we like own all of the websites and primarily spend a lot of time building out conversion rate optimization tests to improve the number of our, the amount of traffic that actually converts into all these different things. So like full funnel growth, like right from the point where we acquire a visitor, we run similar processes to test all the way down to when they actually pay us money and retain.
In that whole funnel, where has been the biggest like pain point or struggle in terms of like pushing them down to from awareness to all the way to actually becoming, you know, full-fledged HubSpot typical active user?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So typically when you run a freemium business model, you expect your conversion rates to be low, right? Because you are going for the broad market. And we've seen okay, actually, monetization rates in comparison to like other companies that I know in terms of, I know the conversion rates because I spend a lot of time talking to other companies. But we still, I think where we see some of the biggest upsides, like points of leverage that we can still focus on is like the activation and how we activate users and actually teams, right? So how we can get users within the HubSpot platform, and then we can get them to invite other people and start to use the HubSpot platform. Because we know that if we get more than one person using the platform in a given week, our ability to monetize that team is just way, way higher. I think like a magnitude of like 5-6x on a single user. And the complexity for us is that we have a very robust platform that has a lot of different use cases for sales and marketers, and trying to focus in on the one thing we want those people to do within that first number of days to see the true value of the platform is more problematic from us versus, you know, a single point solution type company where there's like one specific use case and it's very easy to understand why that user's coming in and signing up for that product.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. What I'm hearing is activation is a big thing for trying to really optimize that part of the funnel. What does your process look like right now? Like, what process have you implemented or have you adopted to run experiments or to improve, let's say, activation metrics?
Yeah, so it's not too dissimilar from, like, I think just a good test program or even like the way we run CRO tests across the website. Like, it's extracted enough information to form a hypothesis about where we feel there's upsides and trying to get a good cadence of running those tests and figuring out like beforehand how you would scale if you were correct in your hypothesis. Like, a lot of people go into tests and they're like, oh, this is a great thing to test. And if you ask them, hey, if you're right, how would you scale this out? And like, oh, well, it's not actually that scalable. So the results are confined to that test you run. And the other thing I find is like people are obsessed over all of the data. Like, they don't want to be wrong. We've actually struggled with this a little bit. Is like, you want to get all of the data you can to make sure that you're not going to be wrong, right? You only want to do things that you're correct. And I think you have to reframe tests. In my mind, they're not about how do I like double this metric overnight. It's about, it's just another form of research, right? If you, I put tests into the research bucket in the same way that we look at analytics, same way we look at user survey data, talking to users. Like, a lot of experiments are just another form of research where I'm acquiring knowledge to know if this is the correct thing to spend time on or not. And I think if you can do that, then you can reduce the amount of time you need to spend in other areas and try to increase the amount of time you actually spend in tests and get people rallied around the fact that actually if you get information to say that this is the wrong thing to do, it's just as valuable as the right thing to do. It's no different than talking to a user and saying, hey, do you think this is a great thing for us to like provide you? And the user going, no, I wouldn't see any value in that. You wouldn't take that as like, oh, this is a failure because a user told me this is a no. Like, oh, cool, I'm glad I knew that up front before I invested a ton of time and effort in it.
Well, that's fascinating. You talk about tests as being another form of research and learning. There's that tension with teams too. Like, they need to get the quarterly results. How do you encourage that culture of experimentation? Because like, when there's a lot of pressure, people tend to do things that they know will work, right? How do you encourage that culture of experimentation within your team?
So I think you have to have clarity around the goals. You have to have then the freedom for the people within that team to decide how they will hit their goals or not. And if they are going to hit their goals, like theoretically, the way they're going to do that is find a couple of things that they're able to scale, right? Let's say we have a goal of doubling our activation rate. Then if you're coming to the board, if you're coming to the table and saying, well, we should do this thing because it's worked time and time and time again, then yeah, maybe we should, like, I would be okay doing the, if I could hit my double activation rate by doing things that we 100% know work, then we should just do those things. But what, mostly what you find is like people actually are going to that quarter, not sure how they're actually going to hit that goal. And you have to actually give them the freedom to come up with the right test cadence and frequency to get enough results so they can pinpoint exactly where are the areas that we should spend the time and research and resources to like hit whatever goal they actually have. So for me, it's ensuring that the people on your team know they have the freedom to like fail a bunch of times, because it's those things are getting us closer to actually finding that like thing that's going to get us further towards our goals. And actually, you usually find it's not one thing, right? It's a lot of different things that actually will help to make up that actual number. So I think having an understanding of that, getting the team like geared up to have a high frequency of tests, I think that you can definitely do like analysis by process, or I don't know if I actually said that term correctly, but you can slow the whole team down. We're like, oh, we should do another round of user research, we should do another survey. And that's what I'm saying, you can like say, well, this is another form of research, but it allows us to go kind of quicker. And just having that kind of culture, right? Like that, hey, we are people that hit goals, but we are also people that run a bunch of things that are not going to actually work out. And that can be, that is actually complex, because a lot of product teams, if you're asking the product team to invest time and energy into building something, being wrong continually with a product team, it's actually not in your best interest.
Yeah, that's true.
Because then it just actually, they're just going to go, hey, this growth thing is a bunch of nonsense. Like, we just want to go build features and look at NPS.
Right. No, that's a good point. So I've heard this term called, somebody mentioned it to me once, I don't know if it makes sense, called disruptive experiments versus incremental experiments. So I, maybe that's what you're talking about. Once they're like, well, I don't know if this is going to work, it's a little bit riskier. And once they're probably more incremental.
Yeah. 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 We have those. So like big swings or
big swings.
Bets. Yeah. So this is a really interesting topic, because me and I have had debates internally with people around this. And actually there's, I don't have like good answers for any of this. And I think most people have different opinions.
Yeah.
Like, I do have a thing around like, safe bets are things that you can run minimal viable tests around,
right,
and be very confident in the fact that that minimal viable test, the results of that will hold as you scale, right? Like, I know that because of this minimal viable version of this thing that I've run, that I actually can reproduce this at scale and get greater results from it. And the time that minimal viable, and I don't know if we're going off a tangent here, so you can let me know if I do. The time that minimal viable tests are difficult to do at times is actually in the second bucket, which you give, which is disruptive tests.
Right.
Which is when, because we're doing this, we're doing a couple of these at the moment, and it's a kind of like chicken and egg. When we're doing like a minimal viable version of this thing, which is a big disruption in our go-to-market, and you start to go, well, we want to try to invest the least amount of time and resources to prove that this is something we should do or not. But actually, it's hard to build the experience for the user in a minimal viable way, in that if the test failed, we don't know if it's because it's not the right thing to do, or if the experience is just so hacked together that it's just not, it's not a good version of what the end product would be. And I think that is the constant battle in trying. And so when you talk to growth teams, they'll veer towards incremental gains and things they can prove with minimal viable tests, because it's so much harder than to do the big swings if you can't prove it in a minimal viable way. And I find that that is a constant battle. And what we try to do is that we have ones now that are big bets, and we are trying to gather as much information we can and hack together as much as we can, and then make assumptions in other places and decide if we are willing to be wrong in a greater way, in that we would have like dedicated teams doing this thing that we think is the right thing for go-to-market. And it may not be, but trying to get to the point where we minimize the potential of that going, of that not being the right thing to do. Like, so running the test that we can run, gathering as much data, trying to model that, what it would look like in our funnel. But there is definitely interest in battles between the incremental and disruptive tests.
In your past and working in HubSpot, how much of your resources and effort and time you would spend on more huge bets, and then probably majority of the time would be safe bets, like maybe like an 80-20 yep. rule. Like I know that's like
I actually have a great answer for this. Yeah, I have a good answer for this because we actually went through this, and actually this model, pretty sure it was Dharmesh, who like a company-wide model that we use for this kind of stuff, that I actually think was Dharmesh. I came up with it was we have horizons. So we have three horizons. So horizon one is basically the things that are going to make you successful this year, right? So the things that you know will, it's 12-month view of your business, and it's the things that fall into the bucket that will make that 12-month successful. And depending upon where we are, we're like, as a company, maybe 85% there. Then you have horizon two. And then horizon two are plays that you think will work, but they haven't been proven. You have some data to show that they are directionally correct, but they are still unproven and they're not part of horizon one, which means they are not part of how we will be successful in the next 12 months. Mm. As an example, we started an affiliate program recently, and affiliate program next year would be horizon two, in that we would be trying to scale that and monetize it, but it's not part of our demand model, which means I have not counted that in terms of all the things we need to acquire to hit our revenue goal. Everything that comes from affiliate is upside. And the goal for us in that affiliate program, which move it into horizon one, so when we come into 2019, it's a model part of our funnel. And we would spend at 10% in horizon two. And then horizon three are like speculative bets on the future, right? Things that we think are the right things to do today to be as successful as a company tomorrow. And we would spend about 5%. Now, those horizons differentiate the teams. For the marketing, your marketing team would probably be more in horizon two and three, because the marketing team should be at the cutting edge of where you think the market is actually going to go. So if you think about growth teams, they're going to be successful. Most of the things they're going to do are incremental because it's in the horizon one, right? They know that there are things that will actually help them hit that 12-month plan. And some of the disruptive bets are probably either in horizon two or horizon one or horizon three, depending upon how much time you spend on them.
Nice. Wow, that's a very thorough response to that, man. Thanks.
Yeah, it's because this has been my world for the last month of planning out the different horizons. So it's a very timely question that is kind of cemented in my brain.
So you gave an example for Horizon 2 for HubSpot. Do you have any examples of like Horizon 1s that you've done this year with your team, or any ones that are coming up in the new year?
Like things that actually make us successful?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the things that we are great at from top to bottom is like Google generates a huge part of our demand. We have a great SEO team. We have a lot of content we produce. And you can please do interrupt me if this is not the actual answer you were looking for.
No, it is perfect.
But like our go-tos are on acquisition, like the inbound model generates a ton of Google traffic. The inbound campaigns that we run, a bunch of like partnerships that we have and do co-marketing through. In the funnel, I think we can activate users. I think I put that in Horizon 1, and that we have like good onboarding that will help users understand the value of the platform, that we can get better and we can monetize. Like we are very good at monetization of users. Like our actually monetization rates are quite good. The thing to show you like how we think through this, so that there's Horizon 2s that I put in the funnel where, for example, one of the things that I really wanted to build out on the freemium side was a user success coach model, where you as a user can come into our platform and actually live chat with a coach, right? And actually, when you're coming around the product, you're like, oh, I wonder how this works, or does this solve my problem? And you can just like live chat within the product with someone whose only job and the only way that they're comped and monetized is to make you happy, right? To get you to use a platform and activate you on the product. And that's something that we've rolled out and is working well, but probably still Horizon 2, where we really have to scale that out in terms of the coach model, and then have clarity on how we can model in the gains that we'll make on activation and then monetization. So I think that's an example of distinction between Horizon 1 and 2. Things that we've been successful, like in terms of tests, like we've done a pretty good job on, like actually Scott Tyson, who you talked to, has run a bunch of experiments on how to better connect users with people within the funnel, like reducing the steps they have to go through to book time with a rep, reducing the steps they have to go to. Like one of the big tests we ran last year was booking time with an individual or live chat and looking at different close rates and exposing the live chat versus the book meeting. And that's where that's an example of a minimal viable test that actually now rolled into a major project where part of a go-to-market is this user success coach model. So I think that was pretty successful. So yeah, we've had a pretty good year in understanding how we could do better our touchless funnel, improve the ability for people to buy our products touchlessly, and how we surface that within the product, like the ability to buy and then the checkout flow and things like that.
Hey, thanks for listening on this episode. I know, I hope you got a lot of this. I can't wait for you to hear the second part because Kieran just shares some more mind-blowing stuff in the next episode. One of the things I really love he said is that one of the biggest mistakes that growth marketers make is that they become so obsessed about being right that they look at the data and they don't want to be wrong. I think I've been faulted with this in the past. So once again, if you want any quotes from this episode, I actually pulled out the stuff that I really loved that Kieran said. You can go to growthmarketing.today/021. Now, if you have any feedback or questions, like always, feel free to send me a short email at ramley@growthmarketing.today. Other than that, this is Ramley from Growth Marketing Today, and keep on growing. Passion, passion, passion. Pop, pop.